It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Thanks for joining us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up here on Central Time, we'll get a world music sampler from the host of WPR's radio show, Higher Ground.
First, New York just became the first state to completely ban hydraulic fracturing, making it the largest region in the United States to ban the practice and taking a rich natural gas reserve off the table. The decision came after an effective 6.5-year moratorium and an extensive statewide public health review.
During the past decade, fracking technology has created a boom in states around the country, especially places like North Dakota and Pennsylvania. The industry has brought new economic prosperity to long-depressed rural economies and a slew of public health concerns stemming from water and air pollution.
Abram Lustgarten joins us now. He's the energy, water, and climate reporter at ProPublica. His reporting 6.5 years ago originally prompted concern over health risks of fracking in New York State. Abram, welcome to Central Time.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
How did New York make the decision to ban hydraulic fracturing completely?
Politically, that remains a bit of a mystery. I've spoken to a number of people over the last day or so who were surprised by the outcome, folks in the environmental community especially, who didn't necessarily expect a ban and thought that eventually drilling would, it was a foregone conclusion in New York, that it was more a matter of when. So it's difficult to know the political calculations behind the decision.
On a national stage, how significant is this decision?
I think it's a pretty big deal. Vermont had banned fracking, but there's no natural gas in Vermont, so that's more of a symbolic gesture. The Marcellus Shale, which is the geology that bears a lot of gas that underlies New York State as well as Pennsylvania and West Virginia, is huge. It's one of the regions of highest growth in terms of natural gas production, and it's in the places where it's being drilled, it's a significant contributor to energy supplies at the moment. So to have an entire state basically block off access to the northernmost tip of that resource, it's symbolically a big deal, and pragmatically it will affect the amount of energy that's produced.
You started writing about health concerns with hydraulic fracturing years ago. There weren't a lot of solid answers back then. What do we know now that we don't know then?
Unfortunately, the answers are still vague, but the questions are better defined than ever. And that's essentially what the health report that New York's decision was based on said. So it's fairly well established at this point that there are, a pattern of complaints and often risks to water supplies. That methane will leak into water supplies, that there's a risk of fracking chemicals like leaking into water supplies. Likewise, air pollution remains a major concern, leaking methane into the air, which exacerbates climate change and other volatile organic compounds and other sources of pollution. Have been the cause for complaints in regions across the country about declining air quality and also declining health. People complain about everything from headaches to premature births to skin lesions, nervous system disorders, endocrine disruption symptoms, things like that. Since I began reporting on this around 2008, all of those questions have essentially been underlined and have begun to be looked at in the scientific community. There's a lot more study now than there was, but there's still not necessarily conclusive answers. There's a number of studies that are underway and will take a few more years. And the way the scientific establishment works is they sort of reach a consensus view after a number of studies are completed over several years. So basically, we need more time to have real definitive answers.
Yesterday, New York State released a health report about fracking that had been a long time in the works. You're saying there are not a lot of solid answers yet, but based on what you said, did New York decide that the questions and the preliminary findings were worrisome enough that it was okay to put the brakes on at this point?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, that report did not define anything new in terms of dangers that we didn't already know. But it essentially found that the risks outweighed the benefits. The bottom line is what was missing throughout that report. It was an exhaustive review that found lots of problems, but none conclusive. The bottom line is that there was no real reason for assurance in that review of the literature. Lots of inconclusive negative findings, but really nothing that said the opposite. No reason to dismiss the risks. And New York essentially decided that without knowing a lot more, without allowing some of the scientific investigations that are currently underway to be concluded, that they couldn't confidently allow this process to go forward.
In New York and in other states, there's been tension over whether individual communities can decide to ban fracking on their own. Do we have any sort of consensus building around that question yet?
Yeah, the consensus seems to be that those local communities can make that decision. The biggest case has been in New York. There's actually dozens of towns or communities in New York State have banned fracking within their whatever their local municipal regions is. But one of those cases concerning the town of Dryden, New York, went all the way to the state appeals court, the state's highest court, and that court upheld the town's right to make that decision. There's similar cases that have played out and are playing out across Texas and Pennsylvania and elsewhere and in Colorado as well. And you're really seeing that that decision being made at the local level if state regulators aren't willing to make it themselves.
Now, New York also found that royalties to landowners who allowed fracking on their land were regularly withheld. Did that factor into the decision at all?
Well, I haven't heard from anybody this was really an assessment made based on the environmental risk and the health risk. I don't know that was a factor in the state's decision, but it relates to an investigation that I completed earlier this year, which found that landowners who had chosen to support drilling and signed leases to let drilling happen on their land because they wanted a share of that income weren't getting paid what they thought they were owed. And there's actually many contractual disputes between landowners and even the federal government and the drilling companies. And I looked at one case where Chesapeake Energy, which is one of the largest drilling companies in the country, was systematically defrauding its landowners and not paying. So the message there is that the economic benefits in some places really haven't been as great as they were talked up to be. And while I don't think that was a direct part of New York's decision, it certainly makes it a lot easier to forego that economic opportunity.
Parts of Western New York State that were in favor of fracking have been dealing with the post-economic slump that has been lingering in parts of the country, and they saw natural gas maybe as a way to jumpstart their economies, kind of like North Dakota. Did Andrew Cuomo, the governor, have a message for them about what that meant economically now that natural gas money is off the table?
Well, yeah, the western and southern tier of New York certainly needs an economic boost of some kind. And it actually got a double whammy yesterday. Fracking was banned, basically eliminating that possibility for that part of the state. But also there was a ruling that casinos that part of the state was hoping might be built in that region won't happen in that area. So bad news for that part of New York all around. There was no specific message from the governor that I heard, except for a little bit of a distancing from this decision, as if he kind of didn't want to take the blame. What he basically said is, look, I'm not an engineer or an expert or environmental, scientist, so I just take the advice of my experts and let them make the decision. Take that as you will, but that's pretty much what he had to say.
How influential do you expect this decision to be nationally in other places that are having the debate over fracking?
I think it's very significant. Top of the list is a national study that the Environmental Protection Agency has underway. This has been going on for years, since 2011, and it's not projected to be completed till 2016. But it's difficult to imagine that New York State, a significant state with natural gas resources, could make a decision like this and that it would not affect, what happens at the federal level or the perspective that those federal researchers take when they look at this issue. The prospect of localized bans is coming up more and more in places where you wouldn't expect it. A small town in Texas, north of Fort Worth, a huge gas producing area, banned fracking earlier this year. That's not a state, obviously. It's a small local area. But the decision that New York's made, it validates a lot of the concerns. It gives an official, authoritative voice to the environmental community, and I think it gives it will give both pause to federal and state regulators who are considering something different, and also a bit of a tailwind to opponents of drilling in other places across the country.
Abram, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We've been speaking with Abram Lustgarten, energy, water, and climate reporter at ProPublica. Yesterday, New York State became the largest and most natural gas-rich region in the United States to ban hydraulic fracturing completely. A special musical treat and a trip around the world. We've got Dr. Jonathan Overby in the studio with us. He's the executive producer and host of the WPR Weekend World Music Show, Higher Ground. You can hear him every Saturday night from 7 to 11 on WPR's NPR News and Classical Music Network. And you can check out the archives at WPR.org. Jonathan, thanks for joining us.
Well, it's good to be here. Normally, this time of day, I'm taking a big nap in my office, but it's great to be here with you folks. Thanks for inviting me.
You got to catch up on your Z's for your late shift on Saturday
exactly.
night.
That's exactly the point, right?
Well, tell us about the range of music covered by the phrase world music. What does that encompass?
Well, to try to give you a definitive answer would get me in a lot of trouble. But what I will say is that world music is really all music in my thinking. It's a blend of traditional music that began in villages and tribal settings and very early on, and of course out of that setting came what we call classical music today. So what we hear on Higher Ground are traditional styles of music from villages, from people who are creating music as practitioners, and sometimes it's got tradition and a little modernity all mixed in.
And what had spurred your love of world music?
Well, I didn't do so well in college as a musician, so I decided I better study. When you don't play, you teach, or whatever that thing goes. So I got really interested in the power of world music to create greater understanding of people who are different. I think it's a way of reducing human hatred in part, and that's the onus behind Higher Ground.
Now, you get to introduce Wisconsin to a lot of fantastic music, probably sometimes things you would never hear anywhere else. Tell us a little about how you would describe your radio show, Higher Ground.
Well, in a word, it's eclectic, but inclusive. And when I say inclusive, it celebrates women in music, diverse cultures in music, regional things, both styles of music that may be a little bit different for folks who don't live in the West. So part of my goal is to, as I call it, grow people's ears, give them a chance to learn about other styles of music not so familiar, including some songs that are most familiar.
And within, we'll get to clips in just a moment, but within the realm of world music, do we see a lot of boundary crossing, people drawing together different styles from different places?
Well, there is a lot of, as you say, boundary crossing, and some of it works and some of it doesn't. But the reality of it is that people want to explore, collaborate, and blend their sounds with other traditions, and I think that's very edifying.
Well, there's a piece that you've given us to sample, and I guess fusion music would be the term for what this is. And it's a combination I've never heard before, but it's delightful. I want to share that now. Let's take a listen.
I wanted to have that without too much setup there because it's a nice surprise. Tell us about this track and what's going on there.
Well, it's very danceable, as we all could tell.
We were bouncing around
in our chairs. But it's a style of music that is a hybrid between Latin music and Celtic music. And the group is called Salsa Celtica, performing a piece called El Agua de la Vida. It's the water of life. And this particular style of music gives new life to world music. And so musicians like Salsa Celtica are exploring collaborations with other musicians from around the world in very unique settings. And as I said before, some of it works really well. Some of it is still, shall we say, experimental.
I was going to ask you that. Does it surprise you that this works so well? Because this is not a combo I've ever heard before.
I got to tell you, Veronica, when I first heard Salsa Celtica, I was blown away by the wonderful marriage between the two sounds. So as I listened more and more to them, I found other groups, groups that are mixing flamenco music with tango and other styles, and you hear these distinctive flavors. The Gypsy Kings are another group that really have this distinctive sound. So for the most part, it's very enjoyable, and again, it's really some music you can dance to.
Well, your next selection is from closer to home. It's Sweet Honey in the Rock from here in the United States. Tell us a little about the group and the selection you've chosen.
Well, I can't think of a more pivotal, important ensemble group than Sweet Honey in the Rock here in the U.S. And for over 30 years, they've been rendering edifying music from various traditions. And they do so in a positive way, illuminating messages about love, life, struggle, and hope. And their music is just as viable today as it was back 20 years ago, considering some of the social challenges we have in this country.
Well, let's give a listen.
I'm going to get my baby out of jail. I'm going to get my baby out of jail. Said she wasn't guilty. I'm not to pull her bail. I'm going to get my
personal story there with a social context, but the voices in Sweet Honey in the Rock always blow me away. I heard them first years ago, and they still hit you hard, those voices.
Yeah, they do. And with Bernice Reagan Johnson in the lead role there, you get this earthy, wonderful celebration of their messages and their stories, but particularly as a women's ensemble, they're very powerful and still today very highly respected.
And they've built up a huge catalog. Has it been 20 years that they've been around?
Well, in fact, they've been around almost 3 decades, maybe even a little more. And their music is always edifying, but they do it out of love. There's never any angst in their music, but they tell narratives. Sometimes they're hard to embrace, but often they are steeped in reality.
Have you ever heard them live before?
No, I haven't had that privilege, and they're still going. Mm-hmm. They're still going strong, so maybe one day.
Yeah, it's always nice to hear the power of the voice up close and personal. The recording's fantastic as well. Well, we've got that that lush vocal sound from Sweet Honey in the Rock, and not a lot of instrumentation on that, a lot of voices. Now we're going to kind of go to the next one. This is called Deep Forest from France.
And so a contrast there, a lot more electronic sound coming out of France. Tell us about, I had not heard of Deep Forest before.
Well, they're an unusual group, and they're a musical group out of France. And you would call their style of music chill-out music or dance beats. And I love it because it really throws a curve at you about where world music can go when you employ electronic elements. They're a phenomenal group led by a couple of French musicians, Michel Sanchez and Eric Mouquet. And you really get this feeling of modernity in their music. And I like to play it because it gives listeners on higher ground, well, something very different from perhaps what they hear day in and day out.
What do you hear going on in that track? You hear it's from France. I don't listen to that necessarily. Think France. What do you hear when you listen to it?
Well, I hear really some chill-out flavor to the music, but with a groove. And so it sort of draws you in, and you hear this, what I call ethnic electronica. You hear the flavor of the language and the style of music. And so that mix between ethnicity and electronica, which they seem to do very well, I guess I should say, in my thinking, they in fact do. Deep Forest is to be really celebrated for creating within world music a very special genre. Hmm.
Well, that's Deep Forest, and you've got one more clip from us, and you describe this artist as one of, if not the single most important artist in world music. Give us some background.
Well, Youssou N'Dour, only because I've seen him in Morocco and I saw him in Africa, that I've become enamored with his music. I am one of his biggest fans, and I'm really one of millions around the world who think, in fact, he is the most important world music artist. He's from Senegal. He's celebrated all around the globe. He's dedicated to mixing his traditional music, the music of his homeland, wedded to other music traditions around the globe. And he's going to sing a very special song called Pulu Ardo. It's about the shepherd. And this is a really cool piece because it's a tale about a man who loves to tell stories to anyone who will pass by and listen. I have friends like that.
Let's give a listen.
Fignon mujangal ñax mi moko mom dox mi moko mom daf ko don li xarila li bayila nagam yaangi allu bangi baxi mamam pullo ardo.
Wow, is this representative? I'm a musician I'm not familiar with, as I'd like to be. Is this representative of the sort of things we'd hear from him?
Yes, it is, and much more. And I love messing with people's minds a little bit to give them something very different. And you hear the presence of the guitar, a very Western instrument being employed in African music, and people love him for it because he's very in tune to hearing sounds that mix traditional African music with other world sounds.
Well, Dr. Overby, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, this is a real treat. I hope you invite me back. I'd love it.
We would love to have you. This is a labor of love for you.
Yes, it is. Very much so.
So great to have you with us.
Dr. Jonathan Overby is the executive producer and host of the WPR Weekend World Music Show, Higher Ground. 1 year ago today, Reverend Alex G. of Madison's Fountain of Life Church published an essay in the Capital Times newspaper describing the challenges of systemic racism that Madison's black community faces.
He says, while Madison has a reputation for progressivism, it also stands out as being one of the worst places in the country for African Americans to live with regard to things like educational achievement gaps and incarceration rates. The state as a whole faces similar challenges. According to the National Race for Results study, Wisconsin has the distinction of being the worst state in the country to be an African-American kid.
Reverend G's piece sparked a big response from the community, and he brought leaders together in an effort to find solutions.
Also, since then, issues of racial disparities and criminal justice around the country have received increasing attention since the protests in Ferguson following Michael Brown's killing and a subsequent decision not to indict the officer involved.
On the anniversary of Reverend G's essay, we've invited him back to Central Time to talk about what's changed since last year and what he's working on now. Reverend G, thank you so much for coming back.
It's good to be back here. It's hard to believe that it's been a year.
It's been a year. It went quickly. So to refresh our memories about what's happened in that year, what brought you first to that essay published called Justified Anger?
A number of personal experiences, including having a run-in with the police in our church department, in our church parking lot, being asked what I was doing there and questioned, while my white associate was parked there before I arrived and was never questioned and had no problems being there. And then just some things that my daughter encountered in high school, some what I call poor advice from a guidance counselor, places where she was encouraged not to apply. I just feel that those personal experiences pushed me to really speak about what was happening in our community. And I wanted to lend my voice to that discussion because I just thought it was important for the community to know that these things were really happening.
And among other things, you did focus on that relationship between the criminal justice system and Madison's black communities you talked about in some of your own experiences. Now, this was months before these issues came to the fore on a national level in light of Ferguson, in light of the decision in Staten Island with Eric Garner. How does it feel to see this become a national conversation?
It's mixed feelings. It's disheartening. I'm a kid who was born in the early 60s. I really thought that these things were a thing of the past. I thought that this is what I would talk about with my grandkids, and we talk about old black white movies, and we talk about how things used to be. But on the other hand, I feel that we do have our finger on the pulse of what's happening here in our community, and we had a chance to have a bit of a what I would call a head start. We began the discussions, begrudgingly at times, but we began the discussions here. Then to see them play out on a national platform, I think helps us to realize that we need to do something differently about our disparities, or we could see a lot of those critical issues happening closer to home.
And one of the things you said last year is that we can only address our issues to the extent that we admit that we have those issues. Do you think that in that year, some of that admitting has happened?
I do. I really think that members of my community, of the African-American community, were probably most concerned about people really admitting that we have these issues. And so I think just being, 8 months into the follow-up of the town hall meeting, which took place in February, to have things like Ferguson play out on a national screen, a national stage, caused people to realize, all right, or if it's not just Madison, if the nation is wrestling with this, maybe we do have some issues at home. So I spoke with a lot of people, particularly I mentioned this in yesterday's article, that many older white Madisonians have come to my office, stopped me while walking, came by our church to say, don't stop. We haven't arrived yet. So there are people who are not only saying we have issues, but don't stop reminding us of this, because unless we acknowledge this, we can't move ahead.
So these conversations are conversations that need to unfold over long periods of time. Do you think Madison has had a head start on this, that the rest of the nation now is starting to join?
Oh, that's a great question. I think in some ways Madison has had several wake-up calls. Now, if that can be equated to a true head start, I'd have to process that a little bit. I think Madison is smart enough and smooth enough to talk ourselves in or out of much of anything. So I think when you have communities like St. Louis, although Ferguson is a suburb of St. Louis, there are certain communities where you know we have issues. I'm sure Cleveland would say, sure, there's some racial issues, Milwaukee, Chicago. Madison continued to say no, 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 no. So although we had my essay, the Madison Prep discussion, the Race to Equity reports, there was still a lot of denial in Madison. And so I think, if nothing else, we have more at stake, because we realize our disparity really sets us up for some real destructive attitudes and behavior. So if not a head start, we certainly have enough fuel or motivation to do something about it. At any rate, I think Madison is poised to do something different. And I think that there's more openness to this, in all honesty, than what we saw 1 year ago.
And you've been on, I guess I can only really call it a journey, this incredible journey in the last year, that you started with that published essay. And I know that you wear a lot of hats. You run a nonprofit.
Yes.
You're a pastor at a church, a lot of other things. And now the Justified Anger Coalition on top of all
yes,
of that. Can you
yes.
just tell us a little bit about what unfolded for you
sure.
since last year?
Well, I jokingly have said to friends in the following few weeks of writing that article, you know, well, I asked, have you ever written something and wished you never hit the send button? And that was one of those things. I feel like I'm the roving affirmative action officer, EEOC officer. I'll get letters from people in who are incarcerated. I'll have teachers call me and say, I have a student who's really good, but I think he has a troubled home life. I'm being called from elected officials on federal levels. I'm talking to leaders of municipalities. Their moms want me to go to court with their kids. I spent time speaking with each of the with African American males at each of the high schools, ex-offenders, all the heads of the black sororities and fraternities and service groups, pastoral leaders, Latino leaders, Asian American pastors. And I feel that I'm understanding our community better and that I'm a more integrated part of it. And I realize that people really do want to do better, but there's so many pockets of the community that does not know or speak to other pockets of it. And we're somewhat suspicious of each other. So the journey has been encouraging, but just heart-wrenching to hear young African-American boys say what they think or what they feel. While at the same time, I mean, my daughter was an honor roll student, an AP student, and took AP classes or an AP class at West, and still had to defend her slot at the university when she told friends that she was admitted, not knowing that she's the third generation Badger in our family. And it would have been disappointing that she didn't get in. But just the thought that it's not only the kids who are struggling who struggle, but the kids who are successful academically are struggling in our schools. And so it's hard for them to focus on being role models to their peers when they are fighting to convince their peers that they actually deserve to be in an AP class or to go to a world-class institution. So it's been quite a journey. That's a great word. But on any given day, I wasn't sure what was going to break my heart or mend it back together.
And you said that it has been something that filled you with hope, and then other times it was wrenching, it was painful.
Yes.
And one thing that struck me in reading your new piece about this is you came across someone who said to you, Alex, this is all great, but when are you going to stop being so angry?
Right. I've been asked that more than anything. I wish, and to which I replied, if we focus on the issues more so than my response, I think people would be fine. I'm not asking people to be destructive or to do anything that's negative. And with the volatility of at-risk communities right now, there's even more of a negative edge added to being angry and black and male. But I also want to hold true that I've been a professional in this community for 30 years. My recent anger has moved me to more community activism than probably, you know, the past two decades combined. So is anger really a bad thing if it moves us into action and out of our comfort? I'd rather for people to focus on the issues and what I'm doing in response to my anger than the word anger. And I wish more of my white colleagues would express that anger with me, because then I wouldn't feel the need to harness that or carry that on my own. Because what we're facing in Madison hinders, you know, the trajectory for all of us. This isn't just, I mean, I see the African-Americans as sort of the canaries in the mine. If these things are happening to us, it won't be long before we see them happening in other pockets of our community. So let's address the issue so we can all flourish.
And now anger has been present at these protests that have
yes.
sprung up nationally. Anger has been a big part of what we've seen in the protests, which are staged die-ins sometimes, a
yes.
lot of anger there. Do you think that people will get past the point that they are uncomfortable with anger and see it as something constructive, see it as a catalyst?
I think some will. I also think that when it comes close to home, they will be able to respond differently. I mean, I grew up in Madison. I've been here most of my life. I was taught to be confident in who I am, to not make excuses, that I'm just as smart, strong, bright as anyone else. And so when my daughter, who was an honor roll student, came home telling me where she was told she wouldn't be admitted, she couldn't get into the National Honor Society because she had missed the deadlines, it became very personal. So I think the combination of the poor guidance that she was getting and my being pulled over by the police made it very personal, and then I acted, and I'm African-American. So I think when these things begin to hit us personally or someone we love, then I think we will take on some of that anger and some of that action. That's what I'm really hoping for. I'm hoping that people will begin to look at folks doing sit-ins or folks who are writing articles and say, I know that person who's otherwise happy-go-lucky and not angry. Something must have gone wrong, and why am I so oblivious to this? And I'm hoping that that will invite people to get to know the issues and not let the emotion define the moment, but the lack of what's not happening really define their action.
And we'll talk more about some of the actions that have happened since that justified
sure.
anger essay in just a bit. We're speaking now with Reverend Alex G. of the Fountain of Life Church in Madison. A year ago today, he published an essay in the Capital Times newspaper. It was critical of the racial disparities in a city that considers itself progressive. It got a lot of response, and we're talking about where things stand a year later.
And you can join in now at 800-642-1234. If you live in Madison, do you see these disparities? Do you see things changing? What do you feel can be done about this? And if you live elsewhere, what is your community's experience like in dealing with racial disparities and related issues? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234.
We're back with Reverend Alex G. of the Fountain of Life Church in Madison. A year ago today, he published an essay in the Capital Times critical of racial disparities in a city that considers itself progressive. It received a lot of response, and we're talking where things are a year later.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234 if you're a member of a minority in your community. Are the ways you feel left out, marginalized? What do you think your community can do to stem systemic racism? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Alex, you've created a Justified Anger website and an idea skill page where you invite people to share their ideas on how to address these disparities in Madison. What are some of the best ideas that you've heard and things that maybe you're moving forward with?
One of my fondest ideas that I heard was, how do we involve service clubs or members of the faith community? We think of, you know, what they do on Sundays when you look at the churches in our community. However, their facilities, volunteers, staff, could they become community centers? Can they become after school centers? Can kids learn there? Can we screen for trauma issues or assess a child's ability to read right in Sunday schools? And so I just think that there are so many service and volunteer organizations that are in our community that have not been at the table. So I think that that part's really important. Idea Scale has helped us to really extend this to the broader community as well, because so many of my listening sessions were with the African-American leaders and influencers. But we wanted the broader community to weigh in because their perspectives really mean a whole lot. Another idea, some of the ideas that came was we can't just be an organizing group that talks about the issues. We need to have a volunteer base that can help create programs or who could show up in important meetings and vote or make their voices known or show up in mass numbers or write emails to a particular elected official or organization to show the strength of our numbers. And these are great ideas that don't cost lots of money to do.
We're going to go to our callers now. Got a lot of folks waiting to talk to you. We'll start first with Carl in Madison. Hi, Carl.
Yes, hello, and thank you for having this discussion. I used to supervise student teachers for the UW's elementary ed program, which put me in a lot of different classrooms around the city. And I have to say, as a white middle-class guy, I had not really entered into this dialogue about equity and justice in the classroom until I saw really profound racial disparities in terms of how students were treated in classrooms and expectations that were set either directly or indirectly by teachers who, I'm not at all vilifying the teachers, but the demographic had shifted out from under them. One such teacher, I asked her as a way to make conversation, hey, how long have you been teaching here? And she said, oh, I've been here since there were just normal kids here. I mean, neighborhood kids. I mean, and then she didn't know what to say. And as somebody who's seen children, African-American and Latino-Latina children who bring a great deal of gifts to the classroom, but sometimes find it difficult when those gifts aren't recognized because they come from a different cultural context, the student ends up feeling confused and then starts to respond to the expectations held for them, and the parent, some distance from the school, feels hopeless and helpless. And boy, in a liberal community like Madison, it's exactly the kind of place where these kinds of really profound questions and injustices can hide. Because you'd think in a Mississippi and an Arkansas that there would be challenges based on their histories, but nobody thinks to look here in our own community.
Thank you so much, Carl. Appreciate your perspective. And Alex, you did a lot of listening sessions with students, African-American students here in Madison.
Sure
does
did.
What you heard resonate with what Carl was saying?
Yes. One of the words that students used from each of the high schools was they said that we don't, or condescending, we don't want people to condescend to us. Have higher goals. Don't lower them. Believe that we can do better. Challenge us. But then I also heard something that I think the broader community may be aware of. The students challenged each other in places where they played into stereotypes. And so not only did they say what they want the teachers to do, they said what they wanted to do themselves. And I thought that was very important. But just listening to them was very honoring. 90% of the African-American males I met with were not aware of a race equity report. They were not aware of the fact that they are the subject of a national discussion of black and white disparity. They were completely oblivious to it. Yet every nonprofit, every governmental agency was scurrying around saying what we're doing and how we're responding to these issues. And 90% of the boys that I met with who were handpicked by guidance counselors were not aware of a report.
Well, a lot to talk about in terms of education there. And
sure.
Beginning. Well, thank you so much, Carl. We're going to go next to Linda in Milwaukee. Hi, Linda.
Hi. I just had a couple comments for Reverend. You know, I feel bad because I had children go through public school in Milwaukee, and now I had two finish up in Madison. And so we spent a lot of time there. And I honestly did not feel that there was racial disparity. I guess in the public high school that my children attended, for whatever reason, though every child had the same opportunity. And for some reason, every time that there was a problem, it was always the African-American children in the classroom who were disruptive. And it causes the other kids to not be able to get what they want to accomplish while they're there. So I think that stems from a home life, whether it's a white child or an African-American child. I don't think it's going to get fixed when the kids go to school.
Okay, thank you, Linda. I want to make sure we have time for a response here. Pastor G.
Sure. One of the things I heard from the young men was that if they had issues of wearing hats or being tardy, the teachers responded to them differently than their white counterparts who were doing the same things. So although I heard what Linda said, I mean, I wasn't there, so I couldn't refute it totally, but I can't imagine a school where only African-Americans are disruptive. Otherwise, in all white communities with all white schools, which are probably both of the schools in rural areas, there are no discipline problems. And I find that very hard to believe. Otherwise, they wouldn't need police officers or truant officers. And so I think we have to even the fact that she or others feel that it's the black kids that are disruptive. And so they make it harder for the other kids to learn. So black kids just come to school and just start acting out. No one else is laughing at their jokes. No one else is being goaded by what they're doing. I think that's part of what the issue is. We focus on the African-American kids and we say that's the problem. And then we never really get at what's really going on in them and in the classroom.
And Pastor G, just briefly, we're about out of time, but during a time when some people are doing soul searching around the country, can you offer advice that you've learned during this past year?
Listen to each other. During this course of the year, we had time for potlucks where people can talk together around race, or just fun gatherings where people can just talk about life. I think we have to lighten up and not be afraid to have the discussion and be committed to the long haul. But I think we act to offer solutions without fully understanding the problems and the issues. And I would encourage community leaders across all sectors, get together, build trust, discuss, and build coalitions and build solutions together. I think they've got to be in issues facing the black community, black led, but community implemented.
Reverend G, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
We've been speaking with Reverend Alex G of the Fountain of Life Church in Madison.